We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you by Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Good evening. Those of you who were here at events last year will remember that we started a series called Faith, in which we sat down with some of the leading Jewish thinkers of our time to talk about matters of spirituality and the influences on them and their own lives. Last year we talked to Rabbi Abraham Twersky, we talked to Professor Lawrence Schiffman, and Rabbi Dr. Daniel Sperber. And we're continuing the series this year, and it's really my pleasure, my honor, to sit down with my mentor, my colleague, and my friend, Rabbi Dr. Natan Lopez Cardozo. And I wanted to tell you something about Rabbi Cardozo before we engaged in our dialogue. He was born in Amsterdam in Holland right after the war in 1946. And he was schooled actually in non-Jewish schools when he was a child. They lived outside of Amsterdam where his parents had moved, and he was 4 years old when they made this move, and later he underwent more of a religious orientation and went to Jewish high school in Amsterdam and did sort of the classical gymnasia training where you take Latin and Greek, that's a thing of the past, I think, and left Holland for Gateshead Yeshiva in northern England in 1964 at the age of 18. And he studied in Gateshead for 8 years, where he got smicha from the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Leib Girvitz, who was the son-in-law of the famous Rabbi Eliyahu Lapian, and the chavruta of Rav Elchanan Wasserman. After smicha, during that time, he'd gotten married to his life partner, Frida, and they already had 2 children when they went back to Holland and began to teach and develop a kollel there. And in 1976, Rabbi Cardozo, at the age of 30, made Aliyah. And 4 years later, in 1980, joined Or Sameach, where he taught for 8 years, and then left in 1988. More on that later when we speak a little bit more in depth on that experience. He's taught in a number of places, in Michala, Neve Yerushalayim. He's made lecture tours around the world. But in 2003, really the culmination of his life's work began when he founded the Cardozo Academy in Yerushalayim, and the academy is named after his father, and he at this point has 5 married children, 13 grandchildren and rising, and a lot of unusual things to tell, so with that brief introduction, we'll get down to business. I wanted to start by asking you about your upbringing in terms of religion. How did your parents feel about religion? What was your household situation?
First of all, I would like to say that I'm most pleased to be here with my two dear friends, Elliot and Jay, and giving me the opportunity here to say a few unusual things about my personal life and also about my insights. Your question, Elliot, really needs a long answer. I come from a very unusual background. I was not raised at all in a religious home, and I actually am the child of a mixed marriage. My father was Jewish, my mother was not Jewish, so at the time when I was born, I halachically was not considered to be Jewish. And we lived an assimilated life in which religion really didn't play a role, but where there was a lot of Jewishness going on. Not that I can actually put my finger on it, but my father was a person who was extremely proud about being Jewish, made it clear to anybody, he was a businessman. Whoever met him, the first thing the person would hear from him is that he is Jewish, and actually from Sephardi, that is Portuguese-Spanish background. In Amsterdam there is a large, or used to be before the war better, a large Sephardi Portuguese-Spanish community, and my father was always member of that community. Our parents, our grandparents came after the Inquisition from Spain and Portugal to Amsterdam, which at the time was the only place, or nearly the only place, where Jews were allowed to go and where there was some kind of religious freedom. My father was really the first one to marry out, and married a very special lady about whom I will say something later. And I do remember that Jewishness played a role, but purely in the cultural and in the social sense of the word. Most of the friends, if I remember correctly, were Jewish. Not one of them was religious. I don't think I ever met in my earlier days any religious Jew. And on top of that, my father, while being extremely proud about his Jewishness, also was a tremendous admirer of Baruch Spinoza, Benedictus Spinoza, the famous Jewish or not Jewish philosopher, the way how you want to see it, who broke away from the Jewish tradition. And my father somehow was a follower of him. I'm not sure exactly how much my father really understood Spinoza, but it was enough to make me to have an interest in Spinoza, which I have up till this very day. I'm reading still a lot about him and concerning him, and somehow Spinoza is responsible for me becoming Jewish and converting officially when I was 16 years old. Long story, Spinoza, as some of you may know, is the person who objected in very clear terms against the Jewish tradition, really broke away. You may remember that Spinoza was the person who called himself into a cherem, into a rabbinical ban, about which there is a lot to be said, and started to attack the Jewish tradition left and right in a very sharp way. And my father used to study this with me, and I kept on asking myself, what is the response of the Jewish tradition to these attacks? And somehow that got me involved in learning about the Jewish tradition. I always say that, you know, I don't know what is happening after 120 years. Some people declare or say that Spinoza is in hell. In case he's in heaven, it's because of me, because he is the one who made me religious. So if it counts over there, then it is because of me. I take that that particular pride. I must say, and also saying, it is perhaps a strange observation to make, but I always have this feeling that I should not have been born, because this was a mixed marriage, and this mixed marriage should not really have taken place. On the other side, I am paradoxically absolutely convinced that I had to be there, and I somehow believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu played a good piece of humor in my family to have my parents getting married so that I could get born and do my job in this world. This may sound tremendously arrogant, but that's not the way in which I mean it. In any way, I always have a feeling that somewhere there was some kind of divine game being played over here, and that therefore I'm able to play a role which perhaps others are not allowed to play, because, yes, a real Gentile, I never saw myself. I always actually thought that I was Jewish, knowing that halachically it didn't count, and that is also because of my mother, who already when she was about 17 years old was raised in my father's family. She lost her parents very early in life, Christians, and was raised in that family, and because of that she later married my father. So she was around it her whole life with Jewish matters as well. I think she saw herself also as a Jewish, also she knew that she was definitely not Jewish. Maybe that perhaps in her family there is some kind of Jewish background, but I'm not sure about that. And they were practicing Christians, actually. I did not know them because they both died long before I was born. And my mother therefore run a assimilated Jewish family. I have a brother who nearly converted but did not make it on the end. I'm very close to him. He is a dentist, he just retired. And so our family situation at home was very unusual. Very strong personality, my father, very Jewish, very Portuguese Spanish. At the same time, a non-Jewish mother who saw herself only within a Jewish setting. And then Spinoza walking in and really creating trouble because undermining somewhere this Jewish identity in many ways, full of paradoxes. And my mother decided about half a year before I got married to convert as well. I'm the only child in the world who married half a year after his parents got married. And so, yeah.
If I have this right,
sure, please do so.
You grew up basically in a very Jewish feeling household, but not particularly halachically observant. Your mother was halachically not Jewish, and I'm just trying to trace a gap here. You said that something about your dad engaging with you around Spinoza, and you began to get some of that fire stoked for Judaism. But how did it actually come that you then took the step of converting, and how did that work? Did you, who you went on your own initiative, or your father took you, or how did that actually happen?
Well, because my father was constantly emphasizing how proud one should be about being Jewish, which he kept on telling me and my brother all the time. So he obviously laid the conditions by which I got more and more interested in all this, and again, also because of Spinoza, reading Spinoza. And so one day I told him, I said, I need to know more about this. So my father was a businessman, but I think he should have become also or a rabbi or a professor or something like that, because it was not in his blood to be a businessman. But this is just after the Second World War, after the Shoah, there was absolutely no money. And he therefore got into business. My father laid, I think, subconsciously many of the, let's say, the attitudes which I had towards Jewishness. He never wanted me to become Jewish, but he laughed it when I made that step. But also objected when I really got into religious observance, which he got scared of. I'll tell you later about that as well. In any way, I one day went up to the Chacham. That was Chacham Rodriguez Pereira, the chief rabbi of the Sephardi community in Amsterdam, a very dignified person. We were all a little scared of him. And I went to him and I said to him, listen, I think I should make this step, and I think this was a mistake. He said, no, I won't allow you. He was just challenging me. But he didn't understand the situation of a child out of a mixed marriage. You are not Jewish and you're not Jewish. You fall right in between. I don't think he recognized the identity crisis which came about because of that. And he made it quite hard on me. But I insisted and I kept on pushing. I forced him to teach me and to have teachers for me. I had the mazal that there were one or two people in Amsterdam who were Spinoza scholars who were religious. So I had an opportunity there to discuss many things about Spinoza with them from a Jewish perspective.
You didn't tell him that the formative influence on you for wanting to become Jewish was Spinoza.
No. Also, he was aware of Spinoza. He was the man, I don't know if you remember that story, Ben-Gurion once asked if the cherem of Spinoza would be removed. And it was to him he asked that question. So he was quite well aware. He was a man who had a doctorate in philosophy as well. He was aware of Spinoza, but obviously had no sympathies for him at all. But it took me several years before they permitted me to become Jewish. A lot of halachic conditions. I had to know a lot. And it was hard. It was hard, and it definitely didn't create always the right, it was not always the right condition under which that happened, because there was always a pushing away, which now when I look back to it many years later, I think they should have done this differently in cases like me, when you have a child which is not here and not there.
And at home, what was the religious situation at home? In other words, your mother is a Gentile and your father is not. What happens, say, at Christmas time or other holidays?
Yeah. We had a menorah standing next to the Christmas tree.
Oh, you did?
Yes, we had the Christmas tree. Every year we had the Christmas tree and we had the menorah. I don't remember anymore if both were lighted at the same time, in case the dates were the same. I do remember that there were both. There, the Christmas tree over the years got smaller and smaller and smaller and then disappeared. Also with my mother's full agreement. I remember that when it disappeared totally, this was before my mother was converted, I felt bad for my mother that this last non-Jewish thing at home had disappeared as well. And I remember I bought her such a small little Christmas tree to show my sympathy for her. I clearly remember that. Anyway, I should tell you something else as well. Just an incident which is always with me. I told my children not so long, my grandchildren, about this not so long ago. I decided one day that I was going to be a Shomer Shabbat. But Saturday morning was school time, and we had Latin and Greek. And I decided, you know what, I will go to school, because my father didn't like at all the idea that I was staying away, and he was afraid, and he was right about that, that I was spoiling my school days, which I did. And so I decided to go to school on bicycle. Everybody goes on bicycles in Holland. So I went to school, but I said Saturday morning, I won't put on my light. It was absolutely dark, complete darkness in the morning at 8 o'clock, and I'm on my bike without any light, getting to the corner of my street, and a policeman stands there and stops me. And he says to me, what are you doing? So I don't remember exactly what I said to him, but I explained to him that I don't want to put on my light. So the man said to me, you want to go to school and you don't want to put on your light? You're walking. So I walked to school. I got in much too late. Were examinations, Latin that morning. No, French. And I had also decided I'm not going to write anymore. So I was sitting in on my chair with my pen here, and I didn't write. And after time, the teacher comes over to me, who was a very nice man, and he says to me, Nico is it, my non-Jewish name. He says, why are you not writing? So I said, it's Saturday, and I've decided to live a Jewish life. So he looked to me, I still see him in front of him, and he says to me, are you serious about that? I said, yes. He says, I want to see you after the class. So after the class, I came over to him, and he looked to me again, and he said, if you are serious about that, then I will be serious about it. He was the co-rector, the second rector, the second director of the school. And I said, no, I'm very serious about this, and I'm going to stick to this. I really would not like to come to school at all Saturday morning, but my father doesn't want that to happen. So he said to me, if you really are serious, he was a non-Jew, I will convince your father to let you off Saturday morning under the condition that you will do your homework on Sunday. So I gave him a hand and said, that's the deal. And he then called in my father one of the days after that and told my father that I was free Saturday morning, which I think overpowered my father a little bit. He didn't expect that to happen. I'm not sure how happy he was at the time about this. Anyway, I had won my battle and I was off. But we had also Saturday morning a Latin and Greek teacher. And this man, I don't know if he was anti-Semitic, but he didn't like me, and he was altogether not a nice person. Everybody hated him in school. Remember, this is a complete non-Jewish school. There was the only half-Jewish child was me. And this was a gymnasium, a high school. So Saturday morning, no, in the weekdays we had him as well. And I was sitting in the class, and he asked me a question which he had discussed on Saturday morning when I was not there. This was deliberate, and I couldn't answer. And he takes the brush by which you clean the blackboard, and he throws this in my direction to hit me. And I did like this, and the thing went right through the window behind me and cracked the window in pieces. So I got up, walked out without asking permission, walked up to the director of the school and told him what happened. The man walks back with me to the classroom and fires the teacher in front of all of us, on the spot. By that I had made my name, I became immediately famous in the school because everybody wanted him out. And this was the way to get him out, and I became a major figure there since that day. Got all the prestigious, whatever it was. And this was something which stuck with me till this very day, because it was a moment that I had to take action. And Baruch Hashem, I did what I did. And the man was out, and there was a very clear message being sent by the school that under no circumstances they would allow something like that. And then afterwards, I decided to put on a kippah, which is obviously strange because I didn't walk into the school with a kippah. And I told my friends, which were all non-Jewish, listen here, Saturday I'm no longer coming. If you want me to come to the class meetings in the evening, the social class meetings, I won't eat anything anymore. Get me an apple. And for years I was the class representative towards the school. They were always mea achus, as we say in Hebrew, they were 100% nice about it. They always made sure that there was an apple for me. I told them I'm no longer dancing with the girls, which in any way I didn't like too much, so they were fine with that as well. And I had tremendous amount of kavod, which I always got for all of them. But this was a major moment in my life.
Can you tell me around that same time, so you're moving in action towards a Jewish life, you're putting on kippah, you're becoming Shomer Shabbat, Shomer Kashrut. On the learning side, how is that happening? In other words, how are you being exposed to Jewish texts? It's to go from the upbringing you had to going to Gateshead Yeshiva, is quite a bit of a lacuna there. Like that's quite a gap. Was somebody teaching you, and where were you finding your sources of inspiration? Aside from Spinoza, it doesn't sound like it was coming from your father, and you haven't mentioned anybody else here. So I'm wondering how that worked.
Well, the first thing what I did was I read any books I could get myself my hands on. And my father was so good my father was good enough to say, okay, you want to buy books? Abakasha, here you can, I will pay for it. And I bought anything I was able to get. And I remember that the first person that had enormous influence on me was the writings of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, because he was the one who spoke our language. So, and now today everything is translated in English. In my days this was only in German, in Hochdeutsch. This was Gothic German, which every sentence was two pages. This is the way how they wrote in these days. And then you have to remember how it started to make sure that you still understood what the end was. Yeah. But I read everything of his, all the gesammelte schriften, his collective writings. Then I read his Chumash, which is a masterpiece, his commentary. And he spoke to us because he spoke our language. It was a language where he spoke about Jewish mission and about, not just about the pure halachic issues, but what it meant to be Jewish and about pride being Jewish. And that was a major influence at that time. I'm speaking now that I was 16 years old about. Afterwards, there were many more people. I remember there was another book which I still am impressed with. There was the head of the Bank of Israel was called Aaron Bart. His father was a famous professor in the rabbinical seminar, in Berlin. And Aaron Bart had written a book, which I don't remember exactly the English name, but it was a book about Jewish eternity or something like that, which was very well written, which I read several times. It was not an easy book to read. He was a banker, he was a famous banker. And that book also had a lot of influence on me. Sometimes I still give it to people to read as their first introduction. But these were the main people at the time, besides the teachers. There was a chazan in the Sephardi community called Nunes Nabarro. It's a typical Sephardi name, whom learned Chumash with me and the more and the traditional stuff which I had to learn. And I kept on reading anything I could get my hands on.
What would you say the Sephardic background, the Dutch background, did that have any kind of influence? Was that formative in any way in terms of your Jewish vision or your Jewish outlook?
Yeah, you know what? How older I become, and I'm already living for more than 35 years in Israel, the more I realize how Dutch I am. Yeah, and I tell you why, because the Dutch always were very liberal in their approach to life. That's why Spinoza was able to publish his works in Holland and not anywhere else, and why the Jews were able to come to Holland. The Dutch, I think, if I put it in poetic terms, they're all artists, they're all painters. We're all Rembrandts. Only Rembrandt is better than all of us. But they are people who work with colors. And that is part of their mentality, that's part of their culture, which is very fresh. Also, they are very Protestant and Calvinistic. At the same time, there is this very strong relationship with colors, with art, with things like that. And I think in combination with the Sephardi world, which came from Spain and Portugal, also with its colors, with the sun, with the brightness of life, the joy of life, that combination, the Dutch, the Sephardi, in an open society where anybody could say whatever he likes to say, I think that definitely subconsciously played a role with me. And now it becomes conscious at this moment.
Why Gates? How did you know?
Gates it was because it was the only place to go to.
Uh-huh.
There was no other yeshiva. They had taught me, if you want, actually it was a non-Jewish professor in the Amsterdam University where I took courses, and I once went up to him and I said to him, don't you have something on Jewish philosophy? So he says, we don't have a Jewish philosophy department, but why don't you go to a Talmudic college and pick up some knowledge there? I had never heard about the yeshiva. He had, a non-Jew. And so I took off a year. Then I realized the only place where they had serious studies was in Gateshead. Gateshead is your Lakewood, very ultra-orthodox, if that's the right word. But it was a major place of learning. And so I went there. But I tell you, it was a very hard time. Because when I walked in there, I didn't feel at home at all in that place. Everybody was black. Everybody, it was a whole different world. My father took me there, and he told me many years later that he wanted to take the first plane home again with me because he didn't want me to be part of this world. On top of that, they spoke Yiddish there. And you have to understand, for Sephardi to speak Yiddish, that's absolutely, that is really heresy. And it took a long time. I didn't like it at all. That is to say, the environment I didn't like. The people were outstanding. The students were fantastic. The teachers were really real, as they say, mention. And they did everything. But it was a world which I had no part in yet. But I loved the learning there. I remember that I couldn't speak Yiddish, but I knew German. While most of the students were English and didn't know German and didn't know Yiddish. So in the first class, the lowest level where I came, there was a problem, and that is that I understood most of what the teacher was saying because my German was good enough that I could make sense out of the Yiddish. But I didn't understand what he was speaking about because I didn't have the Talmudic background. And the students who knew much more than I did couldn't understand him because nobody spoke Yiddish and nobody knew German. So we made up a deal with the teacher. I would translate the Yiddish into English to tell the others what the teacher had said, and then they would tell me what it meant.
In that time, I see you make a lot of deals in your life.
Yeah, I'm very good at that.
I guess the next sort of major jump was actually Aliyah was coming. Although, if you were Geta between, I guess it was 16 and 24?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's
so
right.
After that, you went back to Holland to Amsterdam?
Yeah, I went back to Holland to start a kollel in The Hague with Rabbi Menachem Fink. And we did that for several years, and then it moved afterwards to Amsterdam, and then I left for Israel. But I was quite involved in teaching students of the university at the time in Holland.
And you met your wife when you would come back to Amsterdam after the yeshiva?
No, I met my wife, actually the first time I met my wife, I don't remember that, but she remembers, is when I walked into a small shul in Harlem. Your New York Harlem with one A is called after Harlem with two A's in Holland. It is a very nice place, actually. But there was a small, very small Jewish community where it was Shabbat morning, a minyan of 15 people. And when I got interested, I must have been 15 about, I decided once to walk into that shul and to have a look Saturday morning. And my wife tells me, I don't remember that I walked in shorts because it just came from tennis. I used to play tennis in these days. And that's where I met my wife. Again, I do not remember that in itself, but afterwards when I got more involved, my parents-in-law used to invite me, because of my wife, for Shabbat, for a meal. And that's the way how I started to know my wife. So I was 21, she was 20 when we got married, but we know each other from, I think I was 17 and she was 16. She knew me before I was Jewish, actually.
What prompted the decision to make Aliyah?
My wife.
Oh.
My wife was a big Zionist because my parents-in-law were big Zionists. My father-in-law always loved to come to Israel. Actually, interesting to tell you, last week we reburied him in Israel next to my mother-in-law. After 35 years ago he had died, we had buried him in Harlem in the Jewish community there. And this week we moved him to Israel. So he on the end found the place where he wanted to be. Very special man. He came from Shklov, which is from East Europe, and had come just before the war to Amsterdam to run away from Hitler. And like my parents, I still have to tell you about that, they were hidden in the war and mated, and afterwards had one child, my wife. And in that way, I met my wife in this particular case. You were asking me something else. What was it?
That's okay. We'll go step to the side. Rabbi Cardozo's mother-in-law, Frida's mother, actually just passed away this past year. Was it
half a year ago?
November, December?
Yeah.
So you're saying that her parents were hidden during the war?
My parents-in-law were hidden in the war. Here I should tell you something about my mother, because my mother, in the time when the war broke out, had just married my father before the war, a few days before the war broke out. And then, when it became clear that Hitler was going to try to take away all the Jews, my mother said to my father, they lived in Amsterdam, bring your whole family to my place, to our place, I will hide them all. I'm the only non-Jewish woman, I can speak with the Nazis, they won't take me away. Hide them all in our home, which was a very small place, and so she brought in my grandmother, and my father's brothers and sister and other people, and they were all hidden with her, which is really the Anne Frank story. By the way, my mother knew Anne Frank, and they all made it, except one uncle after whom I'm called, because he didn't dare to hide. listened to the Nazis and never came back, never returned anymore. But my mother was a hero because she had to stand up all the time towards the Nazis whenever they would walk in to raid and to see where the Jews were. My parents were behind double walls. My father had double walls being built into his house. And whenever the Nazis walked in, they would move behind the walls, bring the other wall in front of them, as happened in many cases, and they just in that way, they couldn't make any sound for hours because the Nazis were looking to see where the family was, and walked out again. It was an unbelievable miracle how they all managed to get through that. But that's the schut of the merit of my mother. Yeah.
We're going to change tack a little bit and talk for a while about your career and also your thought. In your career, you've charted a different kind of path from that which we usually associate, I think unfortunately, that we associate with segments of Orthodoxy. We love to do labeling, we love to call people Haredi or modern Orthodox, and you're obviously much more difficult to categorize, and I see that as a great virtue. I'm wondering, as you were learning and thinking and growing and teaching, what you began to see as the central components of your religious Weltanschauung, your worldview.
Well, let me first of all say something to go back a little bit to what we discussed before. I think with the kind of background you come from, like I come from, you are set on a path which never fits anywhere. I still feel existentially very lonely. I'm an outsider, I'm an insider. I go to a Shabbat morning, I go to a Sephardi Haredi minyan, where an ultra-Orthodox minyan. I like to go there because they take the praying very serious, which is very important to me.
This is
in Beit Vegan in Yerushalayim. I feel at home there, and I don't feel at home there. Very difficult to describe. If they would know what I think, they would never give me an aliyah. But they don't know, and they don't even understand if I would tell them. And that's my muzzle. But on the other side, it also creates a problem for me personally, which I can handle, and that is that my outlook towards Jewishness is no doubt different from the ultra-Orthodox or even the modern Orthodox. I more or less stand on my own there. I am a combination of both worlds in the sense that I've learned in both places. And at the same time, I hope, and perhaps this also sounds arrogant, that I'm above both of them. I see the whole Jewish tradition in a very different light. To be quite honest, and especially lately, I have a feeling that we have not yet discovered what Judaism is really all about. It is still to be discovered. There are still many aspects there which are fascinating and which we haven't yet given it enough attention and to think about, and that has set me in motion in many, many ways. The fact that I believe there's still a lot to come, and I now, more than before, start to see the Jewish tradition in a very independent sense of the word. I live an Orthodox Jewish life. I don't go for reform. I don't go for conservative. Also, I think that we can learn a lot from them. And at the same time, I believe that there is so much still within the Jewish tradition which we have to somehow get hold of, and which we have not worked on yet for all sorts of different reasons, that I'm, in my own little world, I try to do something about it.
Can you give me an example of something you think we haven't plumbed yet?
First of all, I would like to see that Jewish religious life becomes much more authentic. It got terribly stagnated in the sense that we are now somehow doing the motions of everything. We go to Shacharit, the morning prayers and the afternoon prayers, to the evening prayers. And I do that as well, but I must be honest, I have tremendous trouble with doing this. Because how much time can one really pray with the kind of kavana, with the intention that is required when you have the, I would nearly say, the chutzpah to speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Who are you to speak to God and say to God, God, I think you are great. I'm always scared that one day I get a voice and coming from heaven and says, Cardoso, who are you to tell me how great I am? And this is for me a very serious issue. The fact that we just pray for the sake of praying, because that's the motions, that's the tradition, I think that we need to do something about that, by which we make it more authentic, more a matter of integrity, which perhaps may mean that we have to change a little bit the prayers, or that we should not pray three times a day. Also, there are many advantages to do pray three times a day, I'm aware of that. But I think that there are many rabbinical laws who were made and created at the time to increase our religious authenticity and integrity, which perhaps are now doing the reverse. And I sometimes question, therefore, and I know I'm going to say something which sounds heresy, it isn't, but I sometimes ask myself, is it good to keep all the rabbinical laws still going, as they have been doing for a long time and have helped us tremendously, because are we not already at a point where they can't do any more for what they were originally created? And I would like to see much more spontaneity in that respect, perhaps leave people more up. I will speak Sunday morning about it, much more diversity within Jewish tradition or within Jewish way of living. These are serious matters which I think we should think about. I also believe the time has come that we must somewhere, and I know this is very hard and very difficult, but I have a feeling that we have to move in a direction that we have to do away with the distinctions between Orthodox Reform and Conservative. I think it can be done under certain conditions without compromising on matters you can't compromise on. But, well, I can speak hours about that, but I think there are new ways which we have to walk.
So even the little bit that you've said here would lead me to imagine that fitting in with conventional Orthodox institutions would not always be an easy matter, and you can see that I'm segueing into your experience at Or Sameach. We know that you were there for 8 years. And can you review a little bit how it is that you came to teach for them and why you eventually parted ways with the yeshiva and maybe what you learned from that experience in your next ventures?
Yes, let me first of all, to be fair, say the following. I had a very great time when I taught in Or Sameach. I mean, I left there quite a few years ago and by now. And I'm extremely pleased that I left there. I'll tell you in a moment why. But I also have to say, I have to give them that amount of credibility and also a thank you to them in the sense that they did set me on the path I'm now moving. And that is, they gave me the opportunity to teach. They sent me on lecture tours. I had, because of that reason, an opportunity to speak to many people. And for that, I am thankful to the Hanhala that they did that for me. After all, they made sure that I had the opportunity to speak to these audiences. My problem with Or Sameach is that over the years, when I came there, let me put it like this, I didn't know about Baalei Teshuvah movement. It didn't exist in my days. There was no special yeshiva for non-religious people. So when I came to Israel, somebody introduced me to the Hanhala or Sameach. Or Sameach at the time asked me if I was prepared to come and teach there, and I said yes, which by the way at the beginning was a complete disaster because I didn't know how to speak to the Americans. They have a different way of thinking than the Europeans have, and it took me some time to grasp that. They told me at the time, and I asked them, well, who are you? I remember that one of the members of the Hanhala said, we are the place between Harvard and Ponovich. And I like that. Ponovich is the famous yeshiva in Bnei Barak, which is one of the largest Haredi yeshivot in the world, where big people have been produced. And they claimed that they were somewhere in between, Harvard, Ponovich. And I like that. I said, yeah, that's exactly what I'm looking for. In the beginning, I think they were like that. But over a time, Harvard disappeared, and it became complete Ponovich. And I objected against it. I said, you're losing the mission of why you started. You started on the right track. But you're moving more and more to the right. You get overwhelmed by the Haredi community. And I, in a nice way, I challenged them and I said to them, why don't you hold your own ship? Why don't you go the way as you started? Don't give in to all the ultra-Orthodox requirements and demands. And obviously there are also financial issues there involved in the sense that they got a lot of money from that ultra-Orthodox world. If I can say it in a few words, I think they did not have the courage to stand on their own feet. And that on the end they gave in to the ultra-Orthodox world and started to become much more right-wing in that respect. And I felt after a time uncomfortable. And I remember one incident where I quoted, not by name, but I mentioned an observation about the Akedat Yitzchak or something about Yitzchak, which came from a conservative rabbi, which I had read, and I liked what he had said, and I repeated that in the class. I didn't say it came from a conservative rabbi, and they heard this afterwards, and they got very upset with me, and I had long discussions with them, and then other issues came up of things which I had been saying in the class which were no longer to their liking. They were once to their liking, but no longer anymore. And it became harder and harder to teach there. And what it meant was that at a certain moment I said to myself, I don't feel at home here anymore. And then something happened which till this day I don't understand why it happened. One day I heard that they wanted to put a chirm on me. A ban on me. I have no clue why they wanted to do that. I made a mistake. I took a lawyer to defend myself against these people. I didn't know what they were going to do. And I got rid of the chirm, which was the biggest mistake. I should have the chirm. I should have made sure that I would have gotten the chirm because it would have made me famous overnight and my books would have been sold much better. But I was too young to realize that at that hour. And I'm still looking for a chirm, but nobody's giving it to me. And the fact is that perhaps you want to. Anyway,
you're talking to
the wrong man, right? Right. And anyway, it became very unpleasant, and I can only say for my family it was very hard at the time because they didn't know exactly what was going on. I was threatened a few times. We were even afraid that I would get some stones through my window. I'm not saying that this came from our Sameach, but there was some talk about this, and that was really scary. And on the end, everything calmed down, and I left, and that was probably one of my best moves I ever made, that I left. But once more, I must also say, they set me on this journey, and they helped me in the earlier days. I find it a tremendous pity that they didn't hold their castle in the sense that they should have done. They could have made a movement out of the Baal Teshuvah movement, which would have really made an impact. In my opinion, the Baal Teshuvah movement did not make an impact. They made many people religious, but they didn't have any creativity whatsoever. I objected against the fact that I used to teach in the introduction program. And there, people, you could speak about a lot of things which were more modern Orthodox or whatever name you were. Once the students came out of that program and they went into the real yeshiva, everything what we said in the program was undermined and completely taken off from the table, and it was said that this was only to get them in. Right. And I strongly objected against it.
You're saying that the creativity, the originality of the beginner's program was really just instrumental. It was an enticement to get people in, and then it was just...
I felt it was dishonest.
There's a quote that sort of reminds me of your career. There's a quote by Rav Lichtenstein, in which he says that what he received from his mentors, his teachers, was that the key to confronting life, particularly modern life, was, in all its complexity, was the recognition that it was not so necessary to have all the answers as to learn to live with the questions. Now, how does that sentiment strike you? And does that begin to describe your own experience?
Yes and no. I think that a statement like you have to be able to live with the questions without getting answers is an authentic statement. But I'm also afraid that sometimes it is used as a kind of apologetics. Whenever you don't have an answer, you can always say it is great to stay with a question. And that's not always honest. On the other side, I do agree that religion, if it is properly understood, deals with questions which cannot completely be answered, because religion is basically touching on something which is beyond, let's say, full human comprehension. I think that in itself is correct. Every answer is a killer. Because the moment you've given an answer to a question, it means to say that at that moment there is no longer any challenge. You have answered the question. And I think that's wrong. I think that's not only wrong concerning the Jewish tradition, but I think it is wrong in philosophy in general. You have to keep on asking. The manishtana is everywhere. And the need to constantly say that even when you found an answer, that there is also a question already coming up, I think is most important. I once said to my students, while I'm speaking, I'm thinking about this, that what I find so interesting about the Jewish tradition is that the Jewish tradition will find a problem to every solution. And this is also the halachic way of thinking. Halacha is basically complex. You think you have the answer, and straight away there is something in Jewish law which will say, that's not the answer, it is much more complex. And that also means to say that you're constantly busy with it. There's never a moment that you can escape it, because anytime when you think you found the answer, there is already a problem. And that's beautiful in itself. But I'm afraid that sometimes we also say something like, you know, if we don't have an answer, so, you know, it's great to stay with the question. It can also be an easy way out, which obviously is not what it meant.
I'm wondering, I mean, the education system in many ways, in many schools, is geared more towards the answer than the question. There's a sort of drive for perhaps a kind of artificial certainty. And this is something that many people struggle with, and I'm wondering what you think of it. Is it advisable, let's say, in questions of faith, that one simply trusts in God without inquiring too much? Or is it preferable to open up the Pandora's box, to give faith a kind of good airing out, and debate God's ways and methods, and in order not to feel frustrated by that lack of expression? I think teachers face this all the time. The child will ask a question. It's a probing, challenging theological question. Am I supposed to open this up? Or is it really just contingent on person's personality, perhaps?
Yeah, I've thought long about that question when you posed that to me. I do believe there is something to say in favor of what we call in Hebrew emunah pshuta. That is to say, an easy way of belief without having all the philosophical questions which make that belief much more difficult to comprehend or even to believe. Yes, I'm a little jealous of the people who are having this emuna pshuta. They walk through life in this easy way. Everything is under control. They know exactly why all and everything happens, which is very much, by the way, also part of the Baal Teshuvah movement today. The teachers know everything and they answer everything, and that's the end of the story. Obviously, anybody who studied any philosophy, any religious philosophy, quite well knows that on every corner there are problems. There's no doubt about that. The only thing what I would say is this. We can argue about God. We can argue about God's existence, about his interference in this world and so on. And I would still say that on the end, believing in God comes from somewhere else. It is not a purely intellectual undertaking either. It is something very deep. I had that personal experience. I don't know if you can call it a religious experience, but a certain moment that something opens up and you realize there is some kind of a being which is part of your life. Lately, by the way, I'm thinking that perhaps Spinoza's understanding of God is more Jewish than we have been thinking. Also, Spinoza is known to say that there is really no God in the conventional sense of the word. But God, I think, is not an, how do you call that, a kind of being in the sense that he's an entity. He is something completely and totally different, of which we can really have no thoughts whatsoever. He is totally beyond us, he's beyond time, he's beyond space, everything else, which somewhere touches on the philosophy of Spinoza. But at the same time, the Jewish tradition does hold to the personality of God, whatever that may mean, that I can speak to him and that perhaps one day he gave the Torah to us, whatever it is. But I think that we have to think about God in totally different terms than we have been doing in the Jewish tradition, in theology, or in the secular sense of Spinoza, of pantheism, that God is to be found somewhere else. He's not a being in the sense of being in the way as we speak about it in the language, not an entity. And therefore, when you, for example, speak about the Holocaust and you ask the question, how did he allow this to happen? Then I would strongly object against people who are saying he did that because he had to punish the Jewish people for not observing the Torah, its commandments. And at the same time, I realized that he must have had a hand in this Holocaust, one way or the other. Do I know the reasons why? No. The moment I declare that I know why God did what he did, I have already made him into an idol. And that's what I object against, the idol worship of God in the sense of we know why God did things. But I run myself into trouble on the other side, and that is that in the Torah, it is no doubt true that sometimes God says in this Torah, if you don't keep my commandments, you get yourself into trouble, you get punished. My question goes back and says, why did God at all create a world? And even when I would say God created this Torah, why does he create a world that man needs to get punished for commandments he gave? This is a big theological problem altogether. My answer to that is, I do not know. Why not? Because I don't know what I mean when I say God is not an entity. But I do believe in God. Now, you can speak with me about that for hours because it is extremely complicated how that works, and I haven't worked this out myself. But I do believe that our reading of God has to be totally different from anything which we have been doing up till now. If we will ever get there, I doubt it, because our minds are obviously limited in some respect. So I once wrote the following words, I have it in front of me. When you speak about God, it is like explaining a three-dimensional reality with the help of a flat surface. You can't do that. There are limits to what we can do. If somebody would say to me, do you believe that God exists? I would answer, if God only exists and nothing more, I won't believe in him.
Doesn't that raise a problem for, it does raise a problem for many people that I've known, and it's an old problem, it's a Maimonidean problem. Mm-hmm. If you talk about God as this sort of unthinkable, unknowable, ineffable, it almost becomes like a black hole. At the same time, and this is very curious in a way, religion expects, Judaism expects, people to adhere to a very complex, detailed code of law. It assigns judgments to noncompliance. It assigns punishments to noncompliance, punishments that we're only sort of immune from in modernity because of democracy. And yet, all of this hangs on practically a black hole, something that you cannot see, experience, touch, know. So in other words, isn't the Jewish project, and I can only speak about the Jewish project, not, I'm sure there are similar parallels in other religions, fundamentally untenable from that point of view? We're asking people to do something from a foundation that's absolutely unknowable.
No, I don't see it like that. The fact that it's unknowable does not mean to say to me something like that, therefore it is an impossible position. I think that if I accept whatever it means that God is unknowable, then to me that means nearly that anything is possible with him. And if everything is possible with him, it is possible for him to give this Torah. Why? Because he is unknowable, so all the positions, all the options are still open. Right. The question then is, and that is more from the perspective of the Torah than from God, is in what way do I know that the Torah indeed is the word of God? Right. If I have reasons to believe that it is the word of God, even when I do not know at all who that God is, that doesn't make me so much of a problem. It would become a problem the moment that I would undermine the authority of the Torah and say the Torah, like the Bible critics say, is nothing more than the product of a human being. If I would accept that position, then indeed my thesis would fall apart.
So none of these sort of intellectual trends have affected your faith in that way? Higher Bible criticism, semiotics, linguistics, deconstruction, all the things that Levinas, sort of talks about as an assault on modern faith, you find is not disturbing for you?
No, it is disturbing, but not to the extent that therefore I will give up my way of living or my beliefs. I think that they are very healthy, that they keep on challenging me and reminding me of my limits. When you speak about Bible critics, which I've studied in great length, I've written in many pages on it, no, I have never been deeply impressed by the arguments. Also because I realize, this may sound very unusual, but I also realize that Maimonides, his 13 principles of faith, where he said that the Torah is min hashamayim, which means to say that every word which God, which is in the Torah, it was given at Sinai. If you look in the sources, in the Jewish tradition, I'm speaking about the Orthodox Jewish tradition, you will clearly see that there were many opinions which said that's not completely true. If you read Mark Shapiro's work on Orthodox belief, you can clearly see that. I saw this week, interesting, one of the Mefarshim writes that the words Vaydaber Hashem il Moshe Lemor were later edited by later rabbis or the Anshei Knesset HaGedulah and was not in the original text. There are also clear in the Gemara already, there are clear indications there, so I think the question about Bible critics has not so much to do with the question if God gave the whole of the Torah to Moshe at Sinai. It is more a question, is the whole of the Torah written by some form of prophecy? I would say yes, it is definitely written by prophecy. If these were later prophets, or if it was all Moshe Rabbeinu, is a matter which has been discussed in the Talmud, in the Midrash, and in other places as well, and I don't have to accept Maimonides' understanding that the whole of the Torah, as we have it from the first letter to the last letter, was given by Moses, to Moses, better. Which has nothing to do, by the way, with the conservative or the reform movement, which is a different story altogether.
On a simpler level, if you take it outside of the intellectual framework, if somebody, myself, were to ask you, do you believe in providence? Do you believe, to use the vernacular sentence that people use, that things happen for a reason, is that part of your makeup?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I
if I put it very blunt, everything what happens, by definition, happens in the front of the nose of God. And if everything happens in front of God, which I think is a premise which we can't get around with so easily, then nothing is trivial. The moment that something happens in front of God, it must have meaning, by definition. Do I know what that meaning is? No clue, on many of the occasions. For example, the Holocaust. But if you ask me if providence means that there is meaning to everything, my answer is yes. If you're asking me if I know what that meaning is, then on many occasions I will definitely say I have no clue, and I won't buy into an argument which says we know exactly why the Holocaust happened because of this and this reason. God decided to create a Holocaust. But I do believe that somewhere in the mind of God there is meaning which perhaps is not at all open to me in any sense of the word. So here it is a belief that yes, it has got all meaning, but that meaning is beyond time and beyond space. I can't handle it.
Is it legitimate for people to try and interpret the events of history in a religious sense? Is it legitimate, say, for sections of the Israeli religious public to see the events of the Six-Day War and following as a kind of messianic harbinger? Or many other such instances, people look at events that take place all the time, whether it's tsunamis or earthquakes, and they pass judgment. Is that something that's legitimate within the Jewish tradition, or are people just blowing hot air when they do that?
I think it is legitimate in one way, if we can learn from it by saying it may be that this is the reason, and the maybe creates within us a reason to become better people, I would say yes. And then it is legitimate because it creates a greater moral standard or a higher moral standard for human beings. The moment that I'm saying, I know for sure this is the reason why it happened, it's completely non-legitimate. But I definitely believe that we can learn from everything what happened in history so to make us into better Jews or to make us into better people. But it is a matter more guessing than anything else, and I can only say, let's do as if it has this particular message, if that message is a message which helps me to become better people.
Let's talk briefly, before we conclude, about Jews today who I think are caught in a bind. They're caught in a bind between authority and autonomy. You have a lot of Jews who are basically experiencing autonomy from the moment they're born. They want to, especially in the West, they want to think freely and creatively, and many of the other influences in their life encourage them to think independently. And then they reach Jewish tradition, and Jewish tradition is telling them, well, we have authority in your life, and we're going to tell you what to do. So what would you say to the Jew who feels caught in between, who is raised in the Western tradition of reason and independent search for wisdom, but also recognizes a value in authority? How do they negotiate between those two strands?
First of all, I think it is important to be aware of the fact that there is absolutely no rabbinic authority whatsoever. And I tell you why. The reason is because authority means if there is power behind the people who, by way of law, through the police, through the law of the country, are able to get you even and put you into jail or make you also difficulties. A rabbinical authority has today absolutely no power. The only power which they have is if I give them that power. If I say, this is my rabbi and I will listen to him, then he has that amount of power, but that's not absolute power. It is a choice which I made, that I'm prepared to give this rabbi this particular power over my life by saying what I should be doing. But on the end of the day, we are, as I've argued many times, we are only Jews by choice. I can choose to be a Jew, also I'm halachically a Jew, but I can choose to live a Jewish life. Nobody will stop me from doing that. The other way is also true. If I want not to be at all religious and not to live a Jewish life, I have the absolute option to do that. Nothing will hold me back from doing that. So on the end, I decide if somebody has authority over me. He can't come with the police, he can't do anything at all to force me in the sense of full authority. So only thing what I can say is that if people are in need of a rabbi which teaches him or them about matters they don't know enough about, by all means. But then they must make sure, and I worry a lot about that they will ask the right kind of rabbis. Because very often what happens today is that the rabbis who do not have that knowledge or don't have that wisdom, better, that's perhaps a more important word, and then start to run their lives of their followers without having the insight and the understanding what their lives and these people's their lives is all about, they can do a tremendous amount of damage, which they are regularly doing, especially when you live in Israel. And that worries me tremendously. If they now work with a late edition, and that is what they call Das Teure, as it is called, where suddenly the rabbi has a say in everything, as if Moshe Rabbeinu said it himself or God said it himself, I think that's a very un-Jewish idea. That doesn't mean to say that I don't believe that the Torah has a particular way of looking to things, definitely true. Also, there are many different possibilities in that Torah. But if a rabbi, as we hear quite often, says, I said so, and this is Das Teure, this is the last statement about this matter, and you can't do anything anymore about it, I think we are then speaking about the Vatican and no longer about the rabbis. And this particular thing we have, for whatever reasons, obviously, because I think what is happening is that the rabbis, knowing that they're losing more and more of their authority, are going to use arguments to get that authority back by way of saying, we are the representatives of God, and they say this specifically, which is most disturbing, about matters which have got nothing to do with halacha. If they will tell me which is the law, if I should do A or B, and they know more than I do, okay, then I have to listen to them because they have the knowledge. But when it comes to matters which have to do with emunah, when it has to do with matters which have nothing to do with halacha, from where do they have the authority? There was never such a concept of authority that they have the last word. So my advice always is to people is, if they want a rabbi, make sure that the rabbi has a lot of knowledge, but above all is a mensch, that he is a person who has tremendous wisdom, has some insight in psychology. Because in Israel, I don't know about it is here, but in Israel it is an enormous problem when people are sitting and judging about human beings, their lives, especially in the Beit Din and rabbinical courts, when they don't have insight in psychology, they don't understand anything about the marriage and about other issues, and they create disasters. And this must be stopped by all means.
So how? I mean, you're talking about a situation which has engendered a great deal of hostility in Israel towards religious authority. What do you think is necessary to improve the situation? Is it the retraining of rabbis? Is it the educating of the public, both?
Lately, I have come to the conclusion, after reading very carefully what is happening in Israel, that the only way out here is to start a grassroots movement by the people. I think the rabbis have lost much of their integrity. I think they have lost a lot of their influence because of that reason. I once wrote that the rabbinical leaders and thinkers, I have it in front of me, need to cook up a storm which will take over, in a good sense of the word, Israeli society. They are absolutely, at this hour, incapable of doing anything like that. You need rabbis with a knife between their teeth, as they say, who are prepared to risk their own lives and their own integrity for the truth. At the moment, most rabbis, and there are exceptions to the rule, no doubt there are important exceptions to the rule, are looking over their shoulders, and they are asking, what is my colleague going to say about this? and how will he understand me, and so on. This is terribly disturbing, to say the least. That is a complete lack of integrity, basically. I don't see hope in the rabbis. I'm myself one. I don't believe that the rabbis are going to change anything. I think what needs to happen is that the people in Israel, I'm speaking mostly about Israel because, after all, that's the center today of the Jewish world, they have to wake up and to say, we need our Jewish identity back. We need to understand what it means to be Jewish, because we have lost it all in Israel, and there's a tremendous identity crisis in Israel today. And I think already there are the first indications that this is happening, that people are saying, we need to know what it means to be Jewish. We won't find it as the rabbis, we'll find it ourselves. Today, there is in Tel Aviv, a month ago, I started a Moadon, a kind of a center in Tel Aviv, for completely irreligious Israelis who are never going to become religious. But they're all looking for Jewish identity, because their kids are walking around in the streets, getting involved in drugs, getting involved in money laundering, getting involved in crime and all sorts of things. I mean, Jewish kids, and the reason is because they have no Jewish background whatsoever. Many of them haven't even been in Jerusalem and ever saw the Kotel HaMaravi. Today, many young parents are saying, this can't continue like this, because our children will leave this country. They won't want to serve in the Israeli army either anymore, because why should I serve in this army, which is a dangerous place to go to, if I can live in California, which is much better? So there are a whole lot of young professionals, young parents, who are saying, we need to know to do something about it. Can we do this in the form, shall we become Orthodox? No, that's not for us. But do we want some kind of Friday night experience? Would we like to come a little bit to shul and have our own shul service, which is catered for us? Yes, there are tremendous needs for that. I have started such a program. I tell you another very interesting thing is this. Today in Tel Aviv, a yeshiva chilonit. This is a completely secular yeshiva where they're learning the whole day Jewish texts, Talmud, Midrash, everything else, also Bialik and all the other later people. But why do they do that? The reason is because they want to know what does it mean to be Jewish. And they realize one thing. The Israeli army, even when you are, I have served myself in the Israeli army, is not going to make you into a Jew. And all the other things which have the social concepts are not going to create much of a difference. We have to go back to Jewish tradition. I tell you an interesting story. A few months ago, a friend of mine is walking around in Tel Aviv. And before him, a few meters away from him, he sees an Israeli walking there. And the Israeli has long hair up till here, with earrings here, perhaps on his nose as well. And no kippah on, but his tzitzit are hanging out of his pockets on both sides, under his shirt. So my friend walks up to this fellow and he says to him, forgive me for asking, but explain this to me. Long hair, earrings, no kippah, but tzitzit. So the fellow says like this. He says, you should know there are thousands of us like me. We have come to the conclusion that we need to have some kind of relationship with the Jewish tradition. And each one of us is deciding how we're going to do that. So I said to myself, I'm going to wear tzitzit. Do I wear a kippah? No, I'm not ready yet, and I'm not sure if I ever will be ready for that. I have another friend who puts on every morning tefillin, but for the rest he eats non-kosher, whatever it is, but tefillin he has. You have all sort of combinations. And then he said something very important. He said to my friend, just leave us alone. Don't interfere in us and start telling us how we need to live our lives, because that will be the end of it. We need to grow ourselves into this. We have to become ourselves. We have to identify and to discover that ourselves. And if we just give them a little bit of a push, indirectly, by giving them the opportunity of an environment where they can experience that sort of thing, we would do a tremendous job, better than all the rabbis together, better than the Baalei Teshuvah movements. And that's, I think, where we have to go to. The Israeli government is a lost case, but the Jewish people are not a lost case. They have a lot of potential, and I think that I'm an optimist. I think that in the next 50 years, we'll see complete turnaround, And many Israelis will start their way to find their way back to the Jewish tradition out of their own, not because of any coercion, not because of any laws in the Knesset, purely because they see the need of it in their own personal lives.
Rabbi Cardoza, thank you very much. So I got to ask all the questions this evening, but if anybody wants to ask a question, I guess they can come up.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.